This is Jim Inkster, and thank you for joining us. And our special guest to start our show is Doris Kearns Goodwin. Her interest in leadership began more than a half century ago. She was working as a professor at Harvard, and her experiences working for President Johnson in the White House and later assisting him on his memoirs led to her best-selling Lyndon Johnson and the American Dream. She followed up with a Pulitzer Prize winning For No Ordinary Time, Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt. And this is the time for Doris Kearns Goodwin to unveil another book, which is on the New York Times bestseller list, Leadership in Turbulent Times, a pertinent subject in our time. And Doris Kearns Goodwin, welcome to Talk Louisiana.
Thank you. I'm very glad to be with you.
Well, this is a culmination of five decades of studies in presidential history, and you have studied all of the presidents, and leadership is something that some people believe the great ones are born with, but are they born or are they made?
I would argue that they are mostly made. I mean, it's interesting. Teddy Roosevelt wrote an essay in which he said there's two kinds of success. One is people who have a talent that nobody can emulate no matter how hard they try, like Shakespeare, or a poet like Keats. But most success, he thinks, comes from people who get ordinary talents and they develop them to an extraordinary degree through hard, sustained work. So my guys, if I call them that sometimes because I feel so familiar with them, they did have certain inborn traits. Lincoln obviously had that gift for language, which was extraordinary. Teddy Roosevelt had a photographic memory for everything he'd read or experienced, which helped him in politics. And FDR had an optimistic temperament that he was born with, which was extremely contagious. And LBJ had unbounded energy, or so it seems. But then most of their success is growing in office, learning humility, developing empathy, developing resilience, dealing with loss, and all the things that you have to do as you grow as a person, not only in office.
And all of these men, I think it's fair to say, were complex individuals.
That's right. There's no single path to the presidency. Some come from privileged backgrounds, like the two Roosevelts. Lincoln had an extraordinarily hard life, and LBJ had intermittent hard times. They had different temperaments, different styles. What seems to unite them is that they all had a certain time in their life, their ambition for self, which is what it usually starts off for, became ambition for the greater good. And they learned and were able to acknowledge errors and learn from their mistakes and thus, you know, become larger in office.
And Doris Kearns Goodwin, you note that each of the four men met with dramatic reversals that disrupted their lives and threatened to shatter forever their ambitions.
That is right. I mean, more than I've realized, I think, that their reversals were so harrowing. One of the things Ernest Hemingway once said is that everyone is broken by life, but afterwards some people are stronger in the broken places. Well, how true that was for these four. I mean, Lincoln suffered a near suicidal depression when he was in his 30s, and they took all knives and razors and scissors from his room because he feared that his great ambitions to change the world were just too far removed, that he was not going to be able to succeed in his hopes. And they said to him, you know, you must rally or you will die. And he said, I would just as soon die right now, but I've not yet accomplished anything to make any human being remember that I have lived. So that real ambition and dream to do something that would stand the test of time got him through that low moment. And he went on to lose a few more elections and then finally to win the presidency. Teddy Roosevelt was in the state legislature when his wife was about to give birth to their first child in New York. And his mother, who was only 49, had come to take care of his wife. He gets a telegram saying, congratulations, your daughter is born. They celebrate with cigars. And then not long after comes another telegram saying, you must come home. Your wife is dying and your mother is dying too. His mother had contracted typhoid fever and she died just as Teddy got home. And then his wife died in childbirth only a few years from complication a few minutes later. Mm. So that sent him out to the Badlands, where he became a cowboy, and that really changed in many ways his whole aura, because he became this man of the West as well as the East. And then, of course, FDR had his polio, which took away from him the power to walk on his own. It meant years of striving, trying to manipulate his wheelchair and get down on the floor and crawl so that his back and chest muscles would be strengthened. And he emerged much more warm-hearted and much more able to connect to other people to whom fate had dealt an unkind hand as a result of that experience. You know, in a certain sense, preparing him perfectly for the paralysis of the country and the need to get the country to believe in itself again. And then LBJ is much more complicated, as he always is in all of these stories, but he had pursued power much of his life. He had been an early New Dealer when he was young, but then had given that up for the conservatism of Texas so that he could become a senator, becomes the most important majority leader ever, and then he has a massive heart attack in his 50s, and he wakes up and he says, if I died now, what would I be remembered for? And that was his moment when he went for civil rights in the Senate and then, of course, in the presidency and became, you know, one of those people for whom ambition was for something larger than himself.
And not one of these men lived a long life. Of course, Abraham Lincoln was assassinated, but the others, by conventional standards, did not live long lives. Did the challenges they faced take their toll?
Absolutely. I mean, Teddy was only 60 when he died, and Lyndon Johnson was in his 60s, 64. And you could see in their pictures, in all of their faces, you could see how aging had hit them. And FDR had congestive heart failure, which took really much of his energy in that last years of his life away. But without question, I'm sure the pressures of the presidency weigh on them. Though the interesting thing about all four, well, less so about Lyndon Johnson, they found ways to relax and replenish their energies so that they could recover from the pressures. I mean, Lincoln went to the theater 100 times during the Civil War. He said when the lights came down and a Shakespeare play came on, for a few precious hours, he could forget the war that was raging. Teddy exercised 2 hours every afternoon in the White House. Somehow we think we're too busy to take time off. They were pretty busy with civil wars and World War II and depressions. And yet he was able to have a raucous game of tennis or a hike in the wooded cliffs of Rock Creek Park. FDR had a cocktail party every night during World War II, where the rule was you couldn't talk about the war. You could talk about books. You could gossip. So long as for a few precious hours he could forget the war that was raging. Only LBJ wasn't truly able to relax. When I was with him at his ranch, he had this big swimming pool, but you couldn't really swim in the pool because he had filled it with floating rafts, with floating notepads and floating telephone, so you could work at every moment while you're in the pool. But the ability to somehow find time to think or relax, I think, took some of the pressures off them, and it was a really important thing to do.
In LBJ's case, and you knew him personally, he was consumed with getting to the White House, and ultimately he did in the most terrible of ways. Did the others have that same kind of all-consuming ambition as they moved up the ladder?
That's an interesting question. I mean, I think definitely Lincoln had huge ambition. I mean, we don't always think of him that way because he's got such humility when he comes on the scene. But one of his friends said his ambition, you know, was like an engine that never stopped. And what was interesting about his is that even at 23, when he runs for office the first time, he's talking about his peculiar ambition to be esteemed of by his fellow man and to be worthy of that esteem. It's that larger ambition from the beginning. Teddy's was more interesting. He just went into politics at the beginning, he said, just for an adventure. He wasn't going in to make people's lives better. But then once he got into the State House and he saw the decrepit tenements and he saw the conditions of child labor, he began to want to do something to make their lives better. And FDR was a late bloomer. He wasn't into politics until somebody asked him to run for a seat when he was 28 years old, because his name was Roosevelt in the Dutchess County Democratic District. They figure a lot of old people might think he's Teddy Roosevelt, so he could win both Republican and Democratic votes, and his mother would be able to bankroll the election. But once he got out on that election trail and barnstorming, he realized, this is what I want to be. He was an absolute natural at it. Even though he wasn't a great speaker at first, Eleanor said he would pause so long between sentences that sometimes they feared he would never go on. And then after a while, he was going on so long, they figured he'd never go off the stage. Huh. But LBJ, I think, wanted power in politics from the time he was 2 years old. So his was probably the earliest. His father had been in the state legislature. He trailed him around. He went on the campaign trail. And he knew this is what he wanted most early.
This book from Doris Kearns Goodwin, Leadership in Turbulent Times, is a primer on leadership. And one of the sub-chapters is tell the story simply, directly to the people. Did all of these presidents do that?
You know, that's right. In fact, Lincoln said, people ask me why I tell so many stories, because all of his lectures and all of his speeches, they really tell you where the country was on a particular issue, on slavery, for example, most notably, where it was now and where he hoped it would come. He said, people remember stories better than facts and figures. The story has a beginning, a middle, and an end. You know, I think it's most notable, excuse me, with FDR, when he first comes into office and the banks have collapsed, people can't get their money. They've stood on long lines for days trying to get their money out of the banks. So he closes the banks for a week, and he gets an emergency banking legislation to shore up some of the weaker banks. But then they're going to open on a Monday morning, and he has to persuade people that it's safe now to bring your money back. So he tells the story of why the banks had lost the money. When you put your money in a bank, it doesn't just sit there. It goes for mortgages. It goes for investments. And sometimes, he said, it went to the stock market, which was why they lost the money, and we've shored those banks up. So I can promise you now that with this new legislation, if you bring your money back, it's safer than putting in your mattress. And then still, when they opened the banks that Monday morning, people were terrified in the government. Would they be trying to take their money out? Long lines came with satchels bringing their money back because he had told a story that made sense.
We're visiting with Doris Kearns Goodwin, the Pulitzer Prize-winning historian. Her book is Leadership in Turbulent Times, and we will return after this brief pause on Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster, and we're pleased to have Doris Kearns Goodwin with us for another segment. Her book is Leadership in Turbulent Times, focusing on four of the great United States presidents, Abraham Lincoln, Teddy Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, and Lyndon Johnson. Lyndon Johnson was a pioneer on civil rights, but got his presidency undone by Vietnam. And, of course, he took office when John Fitzgerald Kennedy was assassinated almost 55 years ago. I'm sure you remember that day quite vividly, as do all of us who were alive at that time.
Oh, without a question. I mean, that's one of those dates that's seared in your heart forever. I was actually in college at the time and was heading down to the Harvard-Yale game at Yale on a bus, and they announced on the bus that John F. Kennedy had been shot. And just there was this enormous sense of connection to everybody on the bus for a period of time, and then came the announcement that he had died. So by the time I got to New Haven, he was already dead. And then you just immediately wanted to be with your friends. And then when I went back up to college after that day for the game, you know, nobody left. We just stayed in the dorms watching television, as you did, I'm sure, hour after hour after hour, as did Lyndon Johnson. And the interesting thing is, the very first night he's watching television and all the things that are going on with the murder, of course, of Lee Harvey Oswald as well as JFK. And he comes up then, he said, I know what I'm going to do now that I'm president. I'm going to get the tax bill cut through first, so we'll have more money to spend on the social problems. Then I'm going to get civil rights through. Then I'm going to get voting rights through. And then I'm going to get aid to education through so kids can go wherever they need to. And finally, I'm going to get old Harry Truman's Medicare through. And he got all five of those bills through in the first 18 months because he understood the Congress. You know, if they hadn't done what he wanted, he would have had them sleep over the White House. He would call them every morning. He'd call them at lunch. He'd call them at night. He'd call them at 2 a.m. If he's not there, then let me talk to the wife. If the wife's not there, let me talk to the kid.
Well, if not for Vietnam, he would be remembered as probably one of the five greatest presidents. Vietnam undid his presidency, and he knew it. Was it an albatross that he just could not shake?
Yeah, I think what happened is when Vietnam was first presented to him, soon after he got into the presidency, he was told, unless you add some more troops, it will fail. So he was trying not to fail instead of having a vision of how to succeed. He never really understood, I think, what was going on over there. Foreign policy was not his forte. And then because he cared so much about the Great Society, he never really leveled with the American people about the numbers of troops and the amount of money being spent. So he was projecting progress in the war, which wasn't really happening. So when it didn't happen, when the Tet Offensive came, then all the bottom dropped out of his support, and he was not able to run again as he had hoped he could in 1968 for the presidency. So he carried that enormous sense of sadness with him to the ranch when I was helping him on his memoirs. The only thing that made him happy was, luckily, I was talking to him because the chapters I was working on were civil rights and Congress. So then he'd be really lively talking about the old National Youth Administration, about FDR, bringing rural electrification to Texas. But when he had to talk about the Vietnam War, his voice would drop to a whisper, and he knew that it had cut his legacy in two.
Doris, is it fair to say that each of these men would be considered by some to be a, quote, genius, an overused word, but they were very smart people?
They were very smart people. I mean, they had different kinds of smarts. I mean, it was famously said of FDR, and I think I don't agree with it, that he had a second-rate intellect but a first-rate temperament. He surely had a first-rate temperament, but they were judging his intellect by how well he did in school. He wasn't a great student at Harvard, Groton, or Columbia Law, but he had an amazing problem-solving intellect. He just could see how when he wanted to get kids to work in the forest at the early days of the New Deal, he would put the Interior Department, the Army Department, the Agriculture Department all together, and somehow he could see connections that way. And LBJ had an enormous intuitive understanding of every senator and every congressman to know what they wanted in order to be able to come along with him on a bill. And Teddy Roosevelt, as I said, he was probably the most widely read of them all. He was reading, one time in summer, he was reading 50 books that summer, and he kept reading and learning and had a very expansive intellect. And, of course, Lincoln had the deepest intellect. You know, he was able to just go to the heart of a problem because he was such a deep person, thinking person himself. He's still an extraordinary man. I kept thinking if I could live with him, maybe he could teach you not simply political leadership, but how to manage yourself. I mean, he would say, you know, you can't allow envy or anger or frustration to fester. It's going to poison a part of you. He was somehow able to forget people who had hurt him in the past if they'd be the best person to work for him in the present. He just had an extraordinary emotional intelligence.
And as we look back over time, the United States has had many exceptional people leading us. And right now we have a person who is exceptional in many ways, but some would say in not so good ways. What about where we are now with a president who is not an intellectual, who governs, it would seem, by the seat of his pants?
Well, I think there's two things. One is to remember that we have been through worse times before, so that I think sometimes in the middle of this experience right now, so many people will come up to me and say, how are we ever going to go out of this? This is the worst time ever. It's not as bad as the Civil War, 600,000 people dying. It's not as bad as the Great Depression. Certainly not as bad as World War II. And people living in those eras worried how they would get out of it. And the answer, I think, was that it's not just the leader, but it's the citizens that have to take responsibility. When Lincoln was called a liberator, he said, no, it was the anti-slavery people who did it all. The progressive movement had started in the cities and states before Franklin, Eleanor, and Teddy Roosevelt were able to mobilize it to take some of the legislation that they needed passed. And, of course, the civil rights movement made everything possible for LBJ. So I think people can take some heart in the long lines that were at the polls in the midterms, the numbers of young people who voted exponentially more than in the last midterm, the great number of women who've entered office for the first time. I mean, there is a problem of leadership. My worry about President Trump is mostly the question of empathy. I think empathy is the most important quality that a leader needs to have. And some people are born with it. I think Lincoln was. But mostly you develop it as you get into office, as you go and see other people's points of view and you begin to absorb them. He certainly has understood the point of view of a large number of people in the country, but I keep wishing he'd get on a train and go to the places he lost as well as he'd won. He'd reach out to the people who are against him as well as the people who are supporting him and learn what it is that is making them concerned about his leadership and his ideas on immigration, et cetera, because that's the only way you grow in office. And I think we've got to still keep hoping that most of these other leaders did grow in office. It takes some time, but only if you open yourself up to recognizing your errors and shouldering blame, not pushing blame on other people. But that empathy and humility, I think, are the two traits that we really need to see. And really, the interesting thing to me is that all of my guys, as you said, have suffered loss and became stronger. And President Trump said at one point he'd be the very, very best temperament of anyone who'd run for president because he had never lost. And of course he has lost. He, like everybody else, he lost his brother. He's lost in bankruptcies. If he could only reflect on that and maybe understand it, or even now he lost the House, even though he gained the Senate, if he could think about what that means and have self-reflection, I think he'd be a far better leader. When he hit the 100 days, I remember there was a kind of wistfulness to his voice. He said that running the country was more complicated than he thought. Healthcare was more complicated than he thought. And he'd always worked hard, but he needed to work even harder. And I thought that might have been a moment of reflection. But then I think events just keep coming, someone right after another, and that reflection doesn't seem to take place.
Lastly, Doris, how did your guys, the four great presidents you profile in leadership in turbulent times, how did they view the free press that we revere in the United States?
Well, they all had moments, of course, when they would be angry at the press, but they were able to transcend those moments because they understood the incredibly important partnership that the press played. One of my favorite stories is when Teddy Roosevelt was criticized by a journalist for the memoir he wrote about the Spanish-American War, so embarrassingly criticized because the journalist said he made himself the center of every battle in that war. He should have called the book Alone in Cuba. Uh-huh. And everyone was laughing all at him. And what does he do? He writes the journalist a letter. He said, "I regret to tell you that my wife and my intimate friends are absolutely delighted with your review of the book. Now you owe me one. I want to meet you." So, and then they did meet. They became friends, but they could still criticize one another. And Franklin Roosevelt had two press conferences a week. I mean, think about that. He prepared so much for them. He would be anxious before he went to them, but he knew that the press was the channel toward reaching the people besides his fireside chat. So I think they all understood, and Teddy certainly, if he didn't have the investigative reporters during the turn of the century who really uncovered the corruption in the cities and the railroads and the big companies, he wouldn't have been able to get the legislation through to correct it because they provided the public mobilization. So the best presidents, I think, understand that there'll be moments when you'll get really mad at the press, but in the end, the fourth estate is the press, and it's central to the workings of a democracy.
Well, thank you for joining us. It's an honor and pleasure, and congratulations on another exceptional work, Leadership in Turbulent Times, from Doris Kearns Goodwin. Thank you, Doris.